first of all, thanks, Pastor Solomon and all of LFL for doing this. This is a good event, a good retreat. I wish I had thought of something like this. And then to the speakers here today, it really just, I feel kind of like I don't belong. Somebody, you know, these, it's an honor, honestly, just an honor to be here with you today and be part of it. Here comes the other guy. I'm honoring you now, so.
I can leave.
So it's I've been uplifted today by listening to what's happened in the past. Some of this I knew, of course, but some of these stories were just wonderful to hear that. We truly are on the shoulders of giants. Greatly appreciated. Let me just kind of fill in a little bit of history from when I took on, because, and I told Pastor Feskins this, that I actually literally had to pick up after him.
That's a first.
Because prior to my coming on, this would be like in 95, the board decided that the office, see, by that time we had all these life chapters formed, and you look at a map and so many of them were concentrated in the Midwest, and then here was the office down in Benton, Arkansas. So the board, as I remember, the resolution was to relocate the office in the Des Moines, Iowa area, because that was kind of in the middle of all the flags where the majority of the chapters were. So that may clear up the myth that went around for a long time that the reason the office moved was because the new director was from Iowa, so they moved it up. Or that the new president, Linda Bartlett, was from Iowa. But the resolution was to try to centralize the office. So my first assignment from the board was to go down to Benton, Arkansas, figure out what it was I was as director of this ministry, and then move it to Central Iowa someplace. So, and Ed was gone then, so I didn't have the privilege of his wisdom, so I picked up after him down there. And we spent 2 weeks there. We, meaning Joyce Flancha, who had heard that the office of Lutheran Swipe was going to move up in this area, and called me up and said, I'd sure like to work for Lutherans for Life. And I said, would you like to go to Arkansas? And so we did. We went down there for 2 weeks, and she learned as much as she could about the office procedures and keeping track of chapters and all that stuff. And I learned as much as I could about what it meant to be the executive director of this great, great ministry. And then we literally packed up Lutherans for Life into a 24-foot U-Haul. And it was one of those where you went like this to close the door, and drove it up to Iowa. And we had arranged in the meantime, we didn't know where in Central Iowa we were going to be. We arranged in the meantime, there was a LCMS mission congregation in this little town of Nevada, Iowa. And they offered some of their Sunday school rooms for the Lutherans for Life to kind of headquarter during the week. So we put a lot of stuff in the storage, put what we needed in this mission congregation, and that's where we started working from there. And then eventually found office space right across the street from Faith Lutheran Church. I moved into that office space. And then, unfortunately, Faith, as a mission congregation, had to close. And so we purchased that property and moved back across the street. And that's a great story, too, is when we looked at all the property and everything. We made an offer on this LCMS property. And I went to the Iowa District West Board of Directors to present the offer of the Lutherans for Life board to them. And so I kind of laid it out to them, and then they asked that I leave the room while they discussed it, which I did. Their office manager came out twice and asked me questions, serious questions. I said, man, they're really debating this. And then they called me back in. Now, I've been in Iowa District West all my life. I've been rostered there my whole ministry. So I knew most of the folks sitting on this long board. It was a long board table. I was down at this end. And the district president was on the other end of the table. And when I walked in there and sat down, they were all sitting there looking at me kind of like. And I knew it wasn't good. I knew it wasn't good. And then the district president said, well, Jim, we've considered your offer, and I'm afraid we can't accept it. And I pretty much knew that was coming. And then he said, we'd like to give it to you for less. And then everybody laughed. They just they set me up. So actually, we had to pay less than the offer that we made. And basically, it was just to assume the outstanding loan that was still left on the property. So it was God was at work in all this, as he has been from the very beginning of Lutherans for Life, putting the right people in the right places and moving us along. So that's my addition to the history of how we got to Nevada, Iowa. So we invite the rest of the panel to come forth, I guess. Pioneers, chumps, come forth.
Pine chumps. Well, if you thought moving back up here was hard, you should have been with me moving down there. It's all downhill. All downhill. You put your feet out, try to break, it was tough.
Okay, questions? Or some of you have been pioneers also, you know, who are in this room as well.
Absolutely.
So if you have stories to share and, you know, maybe bounce ideas off of them, let's open it up. Virginia.
I have a question. Now that our constituency out there is getting older and we face some of the challenges of that, how do you tell a Christian that your work is never done? That it's okay for you to keep going even though you're getting older. So you don't have to shut down your life.
You may not like my answer. You want me to go first?
Go ahead.
There's a season for everything. And I don't think age has anything to do with it. I think it's following the Lord's will. I've seen people that can go and go and go, and then they go to heaven. I'm not sure I'm one of those people. But I've also seen people hang on out of a personal need. Not just in Lutherans for Life necessarily, but in churches. When it stymies the very thing you say you need and want, and that's participation and ownership by the next generation, it's hard, it's dicey. I don't know how well I'm going to do with it. I may be lazy enough that I'll do all right, I don't know. But does that make sense to you? I see this in the congregations that I've served in. Everybody wants to be needed, I think, and wanted, but there's a season for everything, I believe, personally. Where does the next generation come from? I guess we could ask that about our churches. At least that's my experience. My children have a hard time with the old paradigm, and I don't know what the answer is to it, except the joy and the life and the passion of Jesus Christ at work in somebody. I don't think age is the issue, though.
I ask the age because they're telling me it's the age. So, I have a situation in Minnesota. I've got a chapter, a life chapter, that's been a chapter for 30 years. They represent 10 churches. And they're thinking that because they haven't gotten any new, younger folks involved, that it's time for them. So, but that's my opinion, of course. So we're creatively going to come up with some suggestions for them. But that they, it's self-imposed. They're saying we've just got to. president's 70 years old. I'm told she's the youngest one, so that's not acceptable. It's like, who cares how old you are if you're still doing the work and there's work to be done? So anyway, there's no magic answer, but you're right. It's the same as our congregations. I think this is going on across the country with some of our life challenges.
I think one of the things I see is, you know, when people get into, they've been doing something so long and doing well at it, it's my thing, you know.
Third question.
I'm sorry. When they, it's like, well, this is my church and my chapter, and, you know, they feel indispensable to the operation, continuation of whatever. None of us are indispensable. When I was a brand new pastor, I remember hearing somebody say, your life, and this is harsh, but you know, you have the impact in life the same as when you pull your hand out of a pail of water. It's hard to believe Gene Garden's gone. You know, I thought, oh, that would be forever, and all of us probably thought that, but she'll be gone, and we'll be gone, and there'll be somebody else, and that's just the way it is. You don't want to hear me anymore. Please,
help me.
I understand this in a way of a calling with a capital C. Mm-hmm. And what is a calling? That is when you're under orders from the Lord to do this or to do that. And here I am, 83, be 84 in shortly, and yet just two and a half years ago, I meet this young pastor in Russia. Along the Volga River, Saratov, Russia. And so I bring him over here to America, and we travel around and take collections wherever he speaks. We did that about 2.5 years ago. We did it again this spring. Interestingly, that guy was ordained now as the bishop of all of the German Lutheran Church of Siberia. I say German Lutheran. It's their German there, like we, most of us, maybe are German here. Nevertheless, here he is. And one of the first things he wants us to do is start a Bible school in Omsk, Russia. And so, 83 years old, so what? As long as I can still walk, I don't need a crutch yet. And even if I did, that would be no excuse. And so, we do it as long as we have the calling from the Lord. The calling from the Lord is not only an inner message, an inner urge, it is also an external opportunity. Like a pastor has a calling to be a pastor. Well, that's only half of it. And then he has to eventually have a congregation or some kind of a ministry. Well, the same thing here too. So we go on as long as we are under the calling. That's the work of Jesus, that's the work of the Holy Spirit, and then our response is to be willing to go, whether it's Siberia or Waco, Texas, or wherever it might be.
I heard you inhale.
I think you know how to ask hard questions. We're kind of in a time of transition, I think, in this country. I'm fond of saying that this little thing here has changed the world. I got one of these for the first time in about the year 2000, doing a lot of international traveling, and as soon as I had it for 5 minutes, I said, I will never, ever be without it again. And it has enormous implications for the way we do things, the way we think. It's coming down to this country, with the President of the United States tweeting every few hours, and everybody is abhorrent and can hardly wait to the next tweet. And that means that institutions like the formal church, organizations from the Kiwanis Club to the Republican Party to whatever, is different than it ever has been before. And I don't think we've quite figured out yet how to harness to carry out the mission with the power that we have with this thing called the internet and the kind of speed with which things can be done. I wish I had a really good answer to say to you. I've always said what I think Ed over there said, and I spent a long time in a position that it would been kind of, you know, people would say to you, well, it's going to happen whenever you go. And I said, stick your hand in a bucket of water and pull it out, and that's as long as there's going to be a vacancy. You know, somebody's going to step in, but you're going to have a calling. I think that you're right. And I'm enheartened. I just met a young lady here from St. Louis University, getting married on January the 6th. I know her great-grandfather, okay, that really makes you feel like a pioneer. She said, did you know Dr. Zone? Otto Zone. And he was an old man at the seminary. He was probably 10 years younger than I am whenever I was when I was there. But to see her and to see Laura, and to me that's the most encouraging thing about being here at this, that we have young people who are being caught up in the mission of what is life, and have a calling and to be involved. That to me is very encouraging. And I think that we're struggling to find out how we can carry out that in a way that is going to be effective. There was a time whenever I thought even denominations were on the way out. In one of our CTCR reports, I talked about ambiguous denominationalism. We got a lot of cafeteria, someone today came up and talked to me, cafeteria Catholics. We got a few cafeteria Lutherans around. People kind of pick and choose. I was on a plane going to New York, Washington, D.C. a few years ago with a Roman Catholic, and I couldn't find a single thing this man believed that the Roman Catholic Church teaches. And he said to me, the Pope's got his views, I've got my views, and I'm just as good a Catholic as he is. And I said, I know a few of those people in the Lutheran Church. And so how do we work in an institution like this that is going to harness the energy and the commitment that we have in a time whenever it is just very, very difficult, and whenever we got everybody putting together kind of their resume of what they believe, teach, and confess about what a whole bunch of things. That makes it very difficult. But I do believe relationships are important. I think having meetings to come together to share people of like spirit about what it is that we believe and teach, and I believe that the Spirit will do its work. I can't give you an answer to say this is the map that is going to be done. But I am convinced, as I said this morning, history is on our side. If there is a God, he is going to have his will done. And as Luther says in the explanation to Thy Kingdom Come, God's will is indeed going to be done. Let's just pray that we can be a part of it.
Yeah, yeah. I'll just pass the microphone back and forth. Well, you got wonderful answers to your question. I it's a group. What else can we do if we? This isn't work. What else can we do? What do you feel called to do? You have to help them discern whether this is a calling or if they're just wanting to keep something going because it's been going. That's not necessary. And as long as it's a historical thing, let me tell you kind of a transition that I witnessed in Lutherans for Life into this new age, kind of a new age in the sense of technology. But I remember when we just, you know, we focused several years ago, we needed to get younger people on the board of directors. No offense to some of the seniors that were there, but we need to get some young folks on. And I remember it was you, it was Stephanie. When you were a younger person back then.
Yeah.
So were you.
Yeah. But it's a very simple thing, but you came to the board meeting with an iPad. With your iPad. Yep, right there. And I have this picture in my mind. Some of the more senior board members went.
It's an abacus.
Yeah. You're like, what is that? So, and that was, it was just kind of a transition. We got Laura on and others, and it's helped us take advantage of some of these technologies that can be a curse, but also a great blessing. And it's, you know, that went way beyond me, and others have taken that and ran with that. Because because I'm not even on Facebook, so.
Your wife is, though.
Yes, you are.
My wife is. Let's not get into that story.
We're waiting for your first tweet.
Keep waiting. Who else? Someone else has some. Pastor Solomon.
Yeah, can you speak to the maybe the one biggest change that you've seen from your first involvement with Lutherans to Life to today?
Okay, since I have the mic, I'll start. But I assume you're wanting all of us to answer that.
I really do.
Yeah, because that's a good one. The biggest change I think that I saw in the 20 years that I was director, almost 20 years, was a more proactive involvement and a greater ownership in our seminaries, universities, and teaching in our churches. Our pastors coming out of the seminaries were more likely than the guys that had been out there, this is in my experience now I'm traveling around, to address these issues and to do so from a gospel-based perspective. So I've seen, I was telling Dr. Napsker at breakfast, we were talking about this, and when I came on just to talk to the seminarians was, oh, I guess you can do that. I remember, okay, good now. But we started, it was interesting, you, early on, you wanted to talk to the graduating men from the seminary. And
first thing we did.
Yeah, and somewhere that got shelved or something, and we started doing that again. And the seminaries, we have Life Team at St. Louis and good
Fort
things.
Wayne's now.
Fort Wayne, okay. So on campus, they're getting it already, and that's made a big difference.
Boy, it's hard to say. I think a lot of our problems in the Missouri Synod have had to do with strategies. I have long felt, and I've been criticized for it, to say that I have to back up a little bit. I spent a lot of time during my ministry in church relations. Our church is not a member of the National Council of Churches, but I met with the National Council of Churches Faith and Order Commission for 30 years as a representative of a non-member church and the Faith and Order Commission, sitting down and talking about the range and the gamut of theological issues with people all the way from the Assemblies of God that are not members of the National Council of Churches to the Southern Baptist, to the mainstream Methodist, Episcopalians, and other Lutherans, to the Eastern Orthodox, to Russian Orthodox, to Roman Catholics. On one committee I served, there were 27 different denominations present, talking about difficult issues. It took a long time just to know what we were talking about, because we use such a different vocabulary. I think that I always went back from these meetings of saying, my, in the Missouri Synod, we have so much unity. Mm-hmm. We are so agreed in what we believe, teach, and confess. I wish people could spend one day in a meeting where there were real theological differences between people sitting there. And that took a year before you could even understand exactly where it was that you disagreed. You just knew you were in different worlds. And what I'm leading up to saying here is that I think we increasingly live in a world that I described in that was described by that young lady who wrote that editorial. We cannot protect ourselves from being in a world of pluralism and relativism. We just can't do it. The very air that we breathe is full of different views, and it's getting that way more and more all the way, all the time. In the area of faith, we've got Muslims across the street in the little town of Washington, Missouri. We have a girl who went through confirmation who has become a Muslim. We went to the Christian ice cream shop, and there she brought in,
those were Buddhists.
A Buddhist. She's a Buddhist. There's a Buddhist temple in Washington, Missouri. Can you believe that? I mean, here she came. I have to teach a Bible class occasionally there at Emmanuel Lutheran, and she's been in that class and comes up and asks questions. I mean, that's the kind of world that we live in. We cannot go off in a little corner and be Lutherans and believers just all by ourselves. And to me, that says that we've got to do a lot more to equip our people to know how to see what is right and what is wrong about relativism. There's so many good insights in that essay that I read, that we live in different ways. And I can remember, I can resonate to that girl when she said, the first time I went to a Roman Catholic church was in Austin, Texas, after growing up in West Texas, where I had hardly ever even seen a Catholic. And we had an assignment to go down to the Catholic church with all those statues in there, idols. That's what I kind of thought there. We want to make sure that we didn't do anything that would give it any indication that we were part of that worshiping community. I finished up my ministry by being a member of the Lutheran Roman Catholic Dialogue at national level. I had members of the Roman Catholic Church coming to me and say, what can we do together to save the ELCA from committing suicide on questions like euthanasia and abortion? And I had the director of the Catholic Bishops Association come to me and say, thank God you, and I didn't agree with their final conclusion. Dean Winthy and I were the only two that didn't sign the statement, but this head of the association told me, I hope we will never have another dialogue without a Missouri Senate representative present. And thank me for being a part of it. And I think I'm trying to say this, we have to do a better job of recognizing that there are certain things that are non-negotiables, but that it is not wrong to talk about things where we disagree as well as we agree with brothers and sisters in Christ in other situations. And we got to learn to do a better job of that, even on this kind of an issue. And to do it, I love the passage that was quoted by somebody here about 1 Peter 3:15. In fact, I have it on my desk. It'll be on my tombstone. And that is, be prepared at all times to give an answer to those that ask of you the hope that you have. And then I think St. Peter was winking at the Missouri Synod. And he said, do it gently and with respect. And we got to learn how to do that. Hold fast, stand firm, and be engaged. That's kind of a trick, but I think that's what we got to do if we're going to win this war quicker and more lastingly. Thus end the sermon.
Preaching, brother.
Big change you've seen.
Big change, yeah.
The question I bring to this is about how many LCMS pastors, what percentage, are involved in any overt, visible way in Lutherans for Life, or even pro-life, not necessarily Lutherans? What percentage would you say? How many pastors, what percentage of LCMS pastors are engaged in one way or the other in some kind of pro-life, visible pro-life ministry?
I don't know that. Pastor Sami, do you have any insights or?
I would look to John, and we would maybe say in the 10 to 20%.
John?
It's purely anecdotal, but I would say 20%. Now, in some cases, that would include some life-affirming wannabes. By that, I mean that we have called, and I mean that in not a negative light. I've called them, somebody's called them, and they say, oh, I'm glad you called. You know, I've been here 3 years. We're not doing anything right now. I felt for a long time that we should be involved. And, of course, now in my case where I'm asking for money, they'll say, I'll be happy to ask our council to do an offering for you. And I'm also going to be thinking, or if you have any other ways that you think we could be involved, let us know. Or they'll say, well, you know, I have been here for a while, and we used to have a group of folks that were involved in pregnancy center, but then they quit doing it, and so we've kind of gotten off the track of the radar, but I really think we should. I would say maybe 1 out of 5, or, you know, the other end of that is, yes, we're involved with the pregnancy center, we have a life team, we this, that, you know, to the full extent, and then maybe some that have one. We always involve New Life Sunday. We may not have a part. We don't have a chapter here. We don't have anybody active in the crisis pregnancy center right now. But we always we probably about 20%, and that would include some, as I mentioned, that are low-hanging fruit that are ripe for picking to get involved with us. They just need to be asked or followed up on. I might add, in my opinion, I have worked for three other ministries, one national and two in Texas. The two in Texas I worked for were the Lutheran Camping Ministry on two different occasions for about 10 years, which was a very hands-on grassroots ministry with a very good track record, both anecdotal and in studies, where folks who have gone to seminary or become a Lutheran teacher or become active, in many cases trace the aha moment to the time they spent at a Lutheran summer camp or as a counselor or whatever. The other one that I spent time at in Texas was a Lutheran foundation, which is more of a financial thing. Finally, Lutheran Hour Ministries. Well, I was there for about 2.5 years. The number of pastors, in my opinion, experience that would go out of for one of those three ministries was much smaller than those that will either already have gone out of their way on behalf of like a Scholarship Center or us, or are either in the process of doing it or willing to do it. Of course, now, is it half empty or half full? We've gone from about having 4% of congregations support us financially now to have 88%. The good news is that's double. The bad news is we still have over 90% to get. So 20% still allows 80%. But
well, and this is my point. Now, you're talking about LCMS. I come from the Free Lutheran Church, very conservative church, very similar in many respects to LCMS. And I don't know what percentage of our people are involved, because in theory, in practice, in written documents, our church is 100% four square pro-life. But how many pastors are preaching, bringing it to bear on their congregations in a realistic way? I don't mean just a casual mention, but some pastors will say, well, I mentioned it on Life Sunday. Well, mentioning it isn't enough. There has to be teaching. There has to be preaching. What can we do in AFLC, in LCMS, and other similarly conservative, Bible-oriented Lutheran churches to awaken until maybe it's only 20% who are totally silent about the issue and 80%? I don't know if it means a letter, a very clear letter, or a call, or literature, or something, asking why is it that so many pastors are so dormant on an issue that is so critical for us and for our society.
Because they're scared.
They're afraid.
They're scared. You
think? Yeah, I think so. It's only going to get worse. I've been approached with requests by people for things that never in a million years would we do, you know, supervise a same-sex marriage or so forth. People don't know. It's moved so far beyond where we are, I think, in the culture that I'm not sure we realize how far it's moved. I remember years ago hearing, I'm a Lutheran convert, came out Roman Catholic tradition, I went to a minor seminary under the law, saved by grace through faith, yee-hee, and excited. But I remember a study that less than half of Lutherans in the Missouri Synod understand we're saved by grace through faith. You did a survey. I think in a lot of ways our people are biblically illiterate. I'm not trying to be harsh. I mean, I was one of those people too. I had to develop a thirst for the word and appreciation for it. I can't tell you how many times I've been the go-to guy for these tough sermons in places I've served. But so many times, people have just, and I think you said this, thanked me this, that, and the other. And I'm wondering what it was I just preached. And it, so it's not me. It's that I think there's a boldness and a willingness to speak the truth. In the way maybe you talked about Gene doing it, in connection with the enemy that we confront, not the enemy that Martin Luther confronted or that our grandparents confronted, but the enemy our children, my grandchildren confront. And that we have to address that and to do it intelligently and to take the hits that are going to come with it. And they do come with it. People quit and they walk out. My last congregation, I participated in the rallies, you know, Freedom for Religion, whatever it was. You know, people were worried about the persecution coming upon Christians, which we see now more and more. I just simply went down to the city square in Buffalo with other members of the congregation that wanted to go. It meant so much to them that I supported them and went and did that. And other people quit the church because I did. I don't think we can escape that. That's going to happen. There's a separation. It needs to happen. It's good. And I'm not even thinking institution. I think the Lord will purify his bride, period. And that's what he's going to do. And we need watchmen on the wall. This isn't just a reformation, a tweak that we need. We need to rebuild the foundations. They've been just destroyed. And we've yielded them up with hardly a fight. And it bothers me to say that. Bummer, huh?
Uplifting so far.
This may be not even helpful, but when you're talking about our churches are illiterate, I've only been doing my job for 2 years, but we are trained and trained and trained, Virginia and I, and Hillary, to help our churches become educated and informed and involved in real life ministry, and that's all hinged on this life team idea that Lutherans for Life has really adopted in the last couple of years, have really put an emphasis on. We purchased the copyright from Churches for Life materials because they were excellent. We purchased that copyright through donations, substantial donations. We went through all that material. Virginia and I were on that committee, Pastor Solomon, Pastor Lick. We went through all that stuff word by word. And to me, that is one of the answers that we need to use in our churches because it's focal and it's adapted to your individual church. I would encourage all of you to look at what the Life Team idea is. Look at the materials. Pray that God would bring a small group of people into your church that are on fire for life with a heart of love and gospel. Because there is a little tool there that I think can ripple through the entire country.
But my question relative to that, because I say amen to that, is how can we take the same kind of thing, adapt it to pastors and leaders, and get that to every pastor? Some might be angry, some will be indifferent, but maybe little by little we can add pastors and leaders, because until they are on board, generally speaking, a congregation is going to be suppressed. So the question is, getting to the pastors, why are so many pastors, you're saying 20% or maybe 20% are active in LCMS, a very conservative, Bible-oriented denomination.
Yeah.
Why only, what about the other 80%? Can Lutherans for Life develop a ministry to the 80%? And whether it's in my church, the Free Lutheran Church, I don't know what percentage it would be, but let's say probably 60% are never talk about it. How do we meet? How do we reach them?
I think somebody had a. You, yeah. Somebody want to respond to?
Me.
To John.
Well, in the 3 years I've been with the ministry, I've come across a lot of things, which you all probably did too. I don't know, my sense is that we could probably increase it from 20%, but I think maybe above a third is probably going to be a kind of a pipe dream. I think the past, I know hundreds of pastors. I know some of them. I've known dozens of pastors for 25 years and more in Texas because I first went to work in the ministry in 91 down there. The agendas that they have, and many of their agendas include loss, the priority of saving lost souls, are far away from Lutherans for Life. Not that they have anything against us, but they figured out what they want to do and how to do it. And you know, when they get the ministry call of the week from somebody like me, as worthy as it may be, they're just going to stay where they are. So I had an experience in the last year where I talked to a pastor face to face. And I walked out of there, and this is a church that probably has 2,000 members. And I said to myself, I wonder if it is even possible, or if it's totally possible, to be confirmed as an adult in this church and have no idea that we're a pro-life church. If I had to bet on that, I wouldn't bet $1,000, but I'd sure bet $5, which is a lot of money for a poor church worker. Because I think it's very possible, because it's obvious that they do absolutely nothing. But the one thing that I wonder, I would appreciate your comments on, is this, right now we have a smaller percentage, I think, that are involved in this. But the very culture that is chipping away at us, I'm wondering at what point is going to force some of our folks to become involved in these issues. And let me throw out a scenario here. Last year in the Missouri Synod, I think the year before, we confirmed 14,000 adults. If somebody hypothetically is in a church where they don't know about our position on abortion, and they don't know our position on gay rights and transgender and all this, because it's never been really, at what point are they in a Fortune 500 company lunchroom sharing lunch with some folks, and their colleagues are saying, well, what did you do this last weekend? And sooner or later, they come to one of the members of our church that has not been involved in any of this or been taught anything about this. And the, I said, oh, well, we had an Oktoberfest last Saturday. It's a great thing for the neighborhood. Get all the kids from there and a lot of non-members. It's wonderful. Oh, yeah, well, where do you go? Well, we go to St. Luke's Lutheran Church down here. Oh, yeah, is that one of those Missouri Center churches? And, well, yeah, it is. Well, at what point does the culture get so overbearing that within a day or two that person is called into the office of the human resources manager and said, you know, we've had a complaint about you. Really? What did I do? Well, we understand that you belong to a church that has a reputation for hating. You know, that you belong to this Missouri Synod Church and that they don't marry gays and they don't do this and they don't do that. And, you know, we just want to let you know that there are some people.
been there.
All right, well,
that's what, you know, we got to smell that smoke.
Ask you all, and also maybe to comment on this church where I've been, where I went, where I had this feeling that you could be confirmed as an adult and not hear any of these social challenge issues, and that one day you may hear about that for the first time from your human resources manager. At what point does the pastor of that church or the leadership decide that they have to fish or cut bait? They either have to join the side they're on, or they have to admit that they're not that really committed to this issue, and maybe they need to go over someplace else. Thoughts, comments?
That is probably, that I would agree with that. There will come that time. But in the meantime, what if LFL started a division or a ministry of some specifically for pastors? Everything was tailored for pastors. And if it's going to be an LCMS environment, tailored for LCMS pastors. Will you get them all? No. Will you get 80%? Probably not. But if we started a specific division, ministry to pastors, would that help? Now, I know when he has come up and talked to Free Lutheran pastors, people are, I hear comments, they're impressed by it. They're grateful for that. But an ongoing ministry to encourage, to teach, to help pastors. You probably don't do it by reprimanding them. You have to get into their mind, their context. Love them, but love them into proclamation of truth.
Pastor Solomon.
Well, if I might add some hope to a conversation that has turned unexpectedly pessimistic.
Thank you.
I would say that I have had the privilege of, just in the short time that I've been director, to visit with a variety of seminaries. So seminaries of my own church body, St. Louis and Fort Wayne, Lutherans for Life, and has been warmly received there. I would say that whereas the number of pastors that I believe are engaged in really understanding where the gospel of life fits into their ministry in the field is maybe 10 to 20% at the seminaries, then I think we're looking at 70 to 80% of those students, thanks to the work of Mrs. Gibbs and Dr. Gibbs and their life team at the St. Louis Seminary. I was just up at Fort Wayne this spring, and the Fort Wayne chapter had arranged a convocation and a chapel service, and was welcomed into the classroom to speak to the students, and the faculty just met with me directly to ask what can we do to be supportive. So I think that's definitely a positive development that gives us a lot of hope for the future. Wade Mobley from Athelbus continues to contact me and say, hey, when are you going to be in the area? Let's get you up there. I was at the Church of Lutheran Brethren Seminary earlier in the spring. Was in the classroom, led a devotion, networked with the students. So this is happening. It's a tougher nut to crack with the generation of pastors preceding mine. And I think that some of that has to do with some cultural sensitivities that my generation doesn't share. So honestly, I think you're going to see things continue to get better in terms of pastors and congregations being more engaged. And John makes a good point. The Holy Spirit is doing the church the favor of allowing persecution.
Yes.
You know, because it is forcing people to take their confession very seriously and see just how relevant it is. And the question is being put to lukewarm Christians. Is this your way of life? Or was it just a hobby? And so that the fact that the culture is polarizing, and that there's decreasing of the mushy middle, that's an opportunity for us.
Yes, it is.
That as we continue to speak with conviction and with cheerfulness and with winsomeness, the Holy Spirit is going to use that to make sure that the message gets heard. And then the results have always been in God's hands. But I don't think there's ever been a better time to be Lutherans for life. We're very grateful for the generations who have gone before us who had, I think, the difficult work of getting the whole thing up from 0 to 60. But we have that momentum now, and I think we're really starting to see it bear fruit. And the next 10, 20 years are going to be the best years of Lutherans for life yet.
No, just a word. I think that's a good comment that you're making, and I think it's hard to measure your impact and what's really going on in the congregations. In Emmanuel in Washington, we have had field workers and vicars for about the last 8 or 9 years. Without question, they have been outstanding people who come in well-informed, likable, know how to relate to people in a positive way, and are well equipped. You don't see a lot of Lutherans for Life posters around Emmanuel. That 20 years ago there were more, right, Janice? My wife taught school there for a number of years, and there were programs, Lutherans for Life. That has kind of faded a little bit, but I don't think our pro-life message has faded in our congregation. I know what the pastors are doing in the confirmation classes, what the teachers are doing in the school classrooms. My son just took a call after 10 years or 9 years of being a parish pastor in Eagle, Minnesota, to the seminary to teach homiletics and systematics. To me, that's a wonderful combination, to get theology into the practical department and to get some practical sense into the theology department. He just had a very successful confirmation retreat up in Iowa. He said they had 25 pastors thinking about this whole way of doing confirmation class. You know, if we're going to really meet our people, we're going to equip them in ways that are not programmatic, but in the ongoing ministry of the church and the congregation so that they are equipped. I said earlier, we can't take ourselves out of the world. We're in the world. We're not of it. And we have to concentrate our efforts on equipping people to be a part of the dialogue with not giving in to the dialogue and not budging on the position that they hold. And that's a little bit of a trick, and I think a lot of people feel inadequate to be able to do that in a winsome way. But I see some signs that this is happening, and I think they're good things that we could be thankful to and not be so, obviously, as you said in our devotion this morning, when we look about what can be done and what we do, we kind of go down in the depths. When we see what we're doing and how what can be done with the Spirit's aid, I think we can feel a lot better. And I think we can be a lot more positive about what's happening.
How's our time, Mr. Moderator?
4 minutes plus. We have supper at 5. So.
I'll take a couple of those. Because I just want to dovetail on what we're saying here. Because part of what I said earlier about this positive change, especially, I see it in our pastors more and more. And there's also another shift that's going with that, and that's realizing that dealing with these life issues, or and we call them social things, we're getting away from that. And like that's a compartment over here. And once a year we'll have a light Sunday.
Right.
And we'll say the A word, you know, maybe, in the Bible study, or maybe in the sermon, certainly we'll pray for the unborn. Now we'll go about the gospel ministry for the other 51 weeks. You know.
Yes.
But there's been a shift by our pastors of understanding that this is part of what we do. It's part addressing these issues is part of the proclamation of the gospel, and that I've had pastors say, "Well, we don't have Sanctity of Life Sunday." I address the sanctity of life every Sunday in the sermon. And when the text allows me to specifically target, I do that. And I think that's what we're seeing more and more of. And we can't even measure that. because they're not ordering life Sunday materials necessarily, you know? But they are really, they're preaching and teaching it. And we're seeing that in the teaching of confirmation too, where, this is a quiz now. I wrote an article a long time ago. It was called Ancient Pro-Life Document Discovered. Who remembers what that document was? What was it, Laura?
It was the Bible, wasn't it?
Not quite, no. Pardon me?
The Apostles' Creed.
The Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed.
I failed.
Yes. But I'm not your boss anymore, so I don't care. But to understand that, you know, you don't have to, and this is, you know, I tried to get my 2 cents worth in when they're rewriting the catechism, the explanation part of it, because where do we deal with abortion in the catechism? Fifth commandment. Where should we be dealing with it? Second article, conception of Jesus. First article, creation of all life in the world. Third article, God calls us as, see, we can do it in all of these areas of our doctrine and teach it. And what I'm saying is, that I'm not standing here saying our pastors should do that. I'm saying our pastors are doing that more and more. And it's just harder to make. Probably a minute and a half left now.
I have a question. How many pastors in LCMS?
Roughly 10,000.
10,000?
Roughly.
How much does it cost to send the mailing to 10,000?
A lot.
13 cents a piece?
Email's cheaper.
Pardon?
Email is cheaper.
Okay, email.
I'll read an email before I read a paper.
Yeah,
free.
Okay, yeah.
It's free.
So, all right, what would it cost in terms of effort, of manpower, and so on and so forth, every year to send a letter or two to every LCMS pastor, to every AFLC pastor, and some are involved, some are not, but address them both.
Pastor Salming?
We should do that. It's a fabulous idea, and I'm glad that you thought of it. We do, as a matter of fact.
He's being a little facetious.
Having a pastor-to-pastor mailing, which I think was the brainchild of Dr. Lamb. And so we do that on a regular basis. And
every year, all the pastors in the LCMS and in our data.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it's just the LCMS.
It's
a personal letter from the director to the pastor.
Okay.
Encouraging them.
Yeah.
And saying, we're here to support you. So it's an encouragement and it's an invitation. That says,
excellent.
We want to partner with you. If you feel like you don't know how to do this or you have some reticence, let us help because we major in this stuff.
Great.
So,
I have one.
Why don't you conclude it for us with
the
last word?
Pray. Pray. I mean, we always say that, I know. As I've gotten older, I'm driven more to prayer. I see, pray to end abortion. You know, this is all too big for us. We need the wisdom. We need the resources. We need the Holy Spirit. We need the only force that can open human hearts, and that's the Lord. So maybe some way to, and not just say, yeah, let's pray, but to truly pray for our pastors and for one another. The other thing I would say is I completely believe that the pastor is at his best when he's equipping the saints to do the work of the Lord. And not to be, look to the pastors to do the work, but to help them share that and empower God's people. And we heard about gifts today. I forget who was talking about it. That's why God gives us gifts. And to see the church unleashed, well, wouldn't that be something to see? And the power that could be unleashed. We talk about pastors, and it's not an easy gig, for sure. But it's wonderful when people come alongside a pastor who's trying to lead in a godly way. And he does his best. It means a lot to them to have his support and his encouragement and to have his back as well. So those are my two things, I guess. Serious prayer ministry and then real disciple making, and that's why I'm thrilled that Sam, you're new Dogmatis is going to have a bunch of stuff in there, and maybe that will make a big difference.
Mike?
I would throw in that teaching children is as much as important as pastors preaching from the pulpit,
yes,
if not even more so.
Yeah.
All the people who want to hurt other people, they start with kids and they brainwash them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had your Owens Mission going. Every time I've been with my wife and she made that presentation, those kids love those little models. And then you've got teachers who teach about life. I think that's as much, or if not more important, than, you know, every pastor's on board.
Very good, yes. We neglected that whole aspect in this conversation, but it's absolutely critical.